Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Blizzard Chat. Today we are speaking to the wonderful Mabel Slattery, who did our show back in January. I actually didn't get to see her live our show, as that was the one Blizzard show that I was not able to attend due to the fact that it clashed with the City Life Awards, which we didn't even end up winning, so I wish I had just stayed at her night and watched all the fabulous comedians there, but can't change that now. And also, fuck, January, that was that 4 months ago already? Where the fuck has this time gone? It feels like years ago. What the fuck is going on? I really enjoyed having this. We had a really nice conversation about what it's like performing stand-up comedy with a speech impediment, which is nice. It's not something I get to talk about very often from other people, and I even learned a couple of things about it that I didn't already know. So yeah, it was absolutely fascinating. Mabel, if you've not seen her, is an absolutely wonderful comedian. She's in this chat, she names drops Mark Steele, and I see a lot of that in her, definitely. Also a little bit of Eddie Izzard, I'd say, as well. She is an incredibly knowledgeable person, has loads of really niche fun knowledge. Well, not all of it's fun, but a lot of niche knowledge about history, which she manages to make fun, is the important part. In the way that only an aspiring teacher would be able to do. And yes, she's got all of that, which is littered throughout this chat as well. There's plenty of times we completely fuck off the topic of comedy in this chat and just talk about some interesting things she knows about history, and indeed from her own life. So yeah, this is definitely one of the, to put it into perspective, most of these chats that I have with comedians last anywhere between half an hour to an hour before editing it down. This one was pushing an hour and 40. Put in perspective how much fun I was having during this chat. I did have to cut quite a bit of it out because a lot of that was just nonsense that wouldn't actually be fun for anyone else to listen to, but I had a good time with it anyway. Bearing that in mind, I hope you enjoy Mabel Slattery. So yeah, how are things with you?
All right, just I smell a bonfire because we've had we've been clearing the garden.
Oh, right.
Yeah, my mum dated the date to builder, so...
Ah, okay, fantastic. That has its perks.
Yeah. I'm stuck with you now, so I'm stuck on the house.
Yeah, might as well make most of the situation, definitely. I can't remember exactly how much I told you about what this is going to be. Essentially, I called it an interview, but it's going to be more like a sort of chat where the questions are kind of there to fill, to kind of drive conversation more than it's like a formal kind of question answer situation. So it's more like a chat. So our last question will probably go off topic. That's absolutely fine. So far they've been sort of between half an hour and 45 minutes. Hopefully it should be much longer than that.
All anyone's got right now is time, so it's all good.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so yeah, first of all, when did you first discover stand-up?
I've been aware of stand-up for quite a long time. Like, my mum and my... Ryan, I'm doing an interview. Sorry, my brother. I'm in the kitchen, so...
Yeah, that's okay.
I'm getting in and out.
That's okay, yeah.
I've known about stand-up for quite some time. My mum's, I wouldn't say she's like a big comedy fan,
yeah,
but like she had like some Billy Connolly videos and things like that.
Classic one, yeah.
But I think the thing that really got me into stand-up, like as something that I was like, oh my god, holy shit, this is amazing, was when I was in school, I got Ed Burns' DVD.
Oh, nice. Which one?
Pedantic and Whimsical.
Oh, that's a really good one. I actually watched that for the first time recently. I picked it up from a charity shop a while ago and just hadn't got around to watching it for ages. It's really good, that one.
It's so good, because yeah, it's his first one, so it's 13 or something years of stand-up that he just sat and then recorded. It's great.
It's fantastic. So weird seeing smoking on stage as well, like, because that was like just before the smoking ban came in as well.
It
feels a lot older than it is because of that.
Yeah, it's amazing though. Like it's I think that was like one of the first things in that sense that certainly of that genre of comedy, because I've always been a comedy nerd.
Yeah.
Like, massively into, the real reason I got the name Mabel is because I'm a big fan of the Papa Bonzo Dumpty Dumpty Band.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And they do a song called Hello Mabel.
Yeah.
And it was easier to say than my real name at the time, so, you know, that made it a bit, you know, so a kind of a weird combination of being a massive fan and being a covert stammerer kind of came together in a fanciful way, and gave me a name that actually quite suits me.
I never really thought like to ask where Mabel came from, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because J is one of those syllables that is really awkward when you've got a speech impediment, I find. So like, there's like really hard consonants are the ones that really fuck you up.
When it's your name, like, it doesn't matter what your name is, I find most people struggle to say their name. Like, it's the really important stuff, which is just the most irritating thing in the universe.
Yeah, I know, like I've got to, if I hesitate before saying my name, it seems like, I do know what my name is, honestly, it's awkward to start.
Oh, the serious amount of people who ask you if you've forgotten your name, then. No!
I've been lucky. I've never had anyone ask that, but I'm very conscious of it all the time.
I'll be fair. The main thing that mine was the thing that I got into saying, because I didn't know how to handle it when I was younger. Like, because like I said, I was a covert stammer until I was about 20, and then I couldn't cover it up anymore, and it came out in full force. And like, if you. I think there's some stuff of mine from very early on YouTube and stuff, and you look at it, like, my stammer is so much worse. And, like, in that it's more severe, and you can tell that I'm not okay with it.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's an interesting thing, because, when you perform with us, there was a little bit of stammering, but, like, you never really let it get the better of you as such. So I think you referenced it once, just as a kind of FYI, this is happening. It did never ruin the flow of a set. It never seemed to knock your confidence at all. How long did it take you to get to that point?
A long time. I did see. This is the thing, because it all sort of ties into the same sort of stuff. Because again, always been a comedy nerd.
Yeah.
Always knew I wanted to do comedy. Wasn't sure what sort of form I wanted to do it in. Dabbled with writing awful, awful sketches for a while, as I'm sure most teenagers did. It's like the comedy version of dabbling with drugs. Like,
dabbling with sketch comedy. I'd argue that was improv.
I dabbled with sketch comedy for a bit, but it was more like a gateway drug to stand-up. So that's the thing, because my ex-boyfriend's an improv, is an improviser. And one of the things that we learned is that I'm not a brilliant improviser. I'm very good in the sense that I'm good at, like, letting other people go.
Yeah, which is important.
Which is great, but I'm a good straight man.
Yeah.
So that all comes, sort of bringing, how that brings it back is, like, I knew I wanted to do it, and then stammer hit, like, just as I was doing, like, sketch comedy, and I was like, oh no, this is really bad. Because it's fine when I've got something that I remember off-piste, but stand-up's a bit more flowy, and I always wanted it to be a bit more improv'd in that sense.
Yeah.
Like, I like stand-up as a conversation.
Yeah.
And so one of the things, and also I was on my degree at the time. I did English with creative writing.
Okay, yeah.
But one of the components was presentation. And I got marked down on this presentation because I hadn't declared my stammer as a disability.
Oh, shit.
So I had to go and get speech therapy. It was very weird, like, and I'd been warned about speech therapy, like, not always, it doesn't always work so well for you and all this kind of thing. And then I went in, and I just happened to get like the best speech therapist. She was amazing, and she was completely up for me wanting to do stand up. Like, to the extent that we spent half an hour in one session before I had a gig, teaching me to say one word, which was a concomitant.
Okay, yeah.
Because no other word fit. I was like, no, you can't replace that word, I'm not replacing that word, because it's genuinely got to the point about 15 minutes in where she was like, can you not put another word in there?
Yeah.
And when your speech therapist is saying that, you know, it's really bad.
How do you think stand-up has sort of affected your speech therapy and your coming to terms with, or like overcoming your stammer?
Well, that's the thing. I would never call it. I would never say it's overcoming.
Yeah.
Because my stammer is totally part of me.
Yeah.
And it's how do I put this? It's really weird because people talk about like, oh well, how I overcame my stammer. The thing is, if you have a stammer beyond about the age of 13, the likelihood is you're always going to have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's just how it works. But I think it definitely got me to be more and more accepting of it.
Yeah.
And that took a long time, considering, like, people used to think I was a character act, which always begged the question, why?
Yeah, that's weird.
Why would I make that my thing?
Yeah.
It's horrible. So that was always a bit weird, or people would like think that it's okay to heckle you and fill in your words. And
oh yeah, I had that a lot in my early days. I hated it so much.
Things like that.
Yeah.
It's sort of like it's a weird thing, but I think having done speech therapy with Linda, shout out to Linda Elsie, she's amazing.
Yeah.
But the coolest thing was, my speech therapist was a stroke expert, so she wasn't really into doing like stammering, but she kept doing it because I was coming in.
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
So, you know, she was great at like helping you manage like anxiety around it and things like that. And like, you do tend to find like the less you are worried about it, the less it becomes an issue in that sense.
Right, yeah.
A lot of the time.
Yeah, I definitely feel that with in my own sense. And yeah, you're right. Overcome wasn't really the word I was looking for. It's, yeah, because
Yeah,
it is very much a you work with, you don't work against.
Yeah.
I feel like that's where I was going wrong. Like with a lot of, because I had mine for as long as I can remember. Certainly going back to primary school. And I had some speech therapy in primary school. But I don't remember a great deal about it, to be honest. I never really got any after that, and certainly in the early days of performance with theatre and stuff, it wasn't so bad, because I find with rehearsed and learnt lines, it was never an issue. Like, I sort of know exactly what I'm going to say, and there's a bit.
Do you know why that is?
I'd assume it was like a kind of muscle memory thing, to be honest, because
goes through a different part of the brain.
Oh, does it?
Yes, the same part of the brain is music. So music and rhythm is the back right of your brain, whereas your speech centre is the front left.
Oh, okay. I did not know that at all. That's really interesting.
So, it's a completely different area of the brain, which is why stammerers can sing.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That's
what people say, like, well, why don't you speak in an accent all the time? Because if I do. So, for example, like if I do my grandmother's accent, I'm completely fine to talk. It's absolutely normal. I don't understand what all the problem is. But people who say, like, why can't you just speak like that all the time? And the thing is, like, don't think I didn't try. but the thing is, like, the more you do that, the more it goes into your speech, that stuff gets transferred over to your speech center.
Oh,
brain,
okay, yeah.
So those sort of things are not good techniques for managing a stammer, but because they don't work in the long term.
No, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. I never really thought of it like that.
But it's really, see, this is the thing about, well, when your speech therapist is a stroke expert, like, she can tell you all this kind of cool stuff.
Yeah.
And when you do speech therapy as an adult, you get to do more of that kind of weird, like, science-y stuff that can make my nerd brain go slightly exciting. But it was, doing the way that I try and, I think the way I was given a very, there's a very simple choice in speech therapy.
Yeah.
And having a stammer in general. And there are two paths you can go down, and they're called speak fluently or stammer easily. So the idea is that either you speak, they kind of speak for themselves, like easy. Yeah. You put your energy into speaking as fluently as possible.
Yeah.
Or you could put your energy into stammering, like making the stammer not so much of a bother, so it doesn't stress you out and it's not actually taking a toll on you as a person. Because if you've got a bad stammer, it's exhausting, it's horrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so it's about making that easier and ways of flowing in that. I knew, because I wanted to do stand-up, if I went down to speak fluently, I'd probably end up sounding like a robot.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. I suppose, yes, because you're kind of not really teaching yourself to speak as such, but I suppose teaching yourself to speak in a certain way that you're kind of negating that, and then that will take a lot of the tone out of your voice if you're focusing on that. I never really thought about it,
I always wanted to sound like me.
Oh, absolutely, I think that's really important. And you also do have a really good you do have a really good voice for comedy as well. I think that you have kept your accent.
That's entirely the fault of my family, I think.
it works really well.
My grandpa has a good voice for comedy. In that speaks in a very drawling Cornish accent. Stories endlessly.
Cornish accents are generally just really good for Harriet Dyer, who I think is one of my favourite acts of all time currently. When she was doing a last preview with us, and I was asking for trigger warnings because I know Harriet Dyer is going to have quite a lot. She ended up telling to me over voice messages on Facebook because she couldn't type at the time. I think she was outside and it was raining or something. And she was listing all these really dark trigger warnings, and it was somehow just hilarious in her voice. And
sounds about right. There's definitely a tone to Cornish people a lot of times. We talk about very serious things in very light-hearted ways. It's almost impossible to be Cornish in a Cornish accent. It's almost impossible to be pompous in a Cornish accent.
I think that's exactly it,
But, we're a really morbid kind of society as well. Seriously, my grandparents and my mum, every week, they are suffering at the moment because every Thursday, West Britain comes. And they can't go pick it up and find out who's died. Every conversation is, you pick up the phone and it's just like, guess who's died? All right. Guess who's died this week? And then my mum's like, no, but there's an element of, it's important because you don't want to embarrass yourself around someone's family member if they died, and because it's a small community. I'm like, oh, come on, mum, you're just making excuses. You want to just find out who died, how, so you can gossip about it. Endlessly over enormous cups of tea, going, well, you'll never guess who's died. It was mother's uncle's cousin brother's son.
I've not really put much thought into it, but I think Cornish is definitely up there for the best accents of comedy. I think Welsh is another really good one.
Welsh is lovely.
Yeah, it's a really good one, and
It's one of the only accents I can my impressions are not brilliant. They're very limited. I'm limited to Cornish.
I can barely do any at all.
But the two people I can impersonate really well are two people that not many people have heard of, which is really annoying because I can impersonate my friend Pesha.
Right.
Who's Pesha Thornton, who's a comedian. Or was, I don't know if she's doing it anymore, but she just goes, Jessica! and she's incredibly Welsh. I smell my wedding dress. I smell my wedding. And the other one's Rivka Utley, who the best phrase from her I've got is she once walked into a room, dropped her bags on the floor, and said, "I just locked eyes with the Morrison's delivery man while we're having a wank."
Oh, fucking beautiful.
Leeds accent I can do. Because I worked in a gym in Leeds for so long.
You will eventually pick it up.
Well, you just hear things like, I'm not doing a yoga class unless it's Raphael, he's a god. Okay. You just got to put those things aside. But I was going to say Harriet Dyer's lovely. I met her a few years ago, and then we were like, oh, how are you, and things like that. And then I realised I went to college with her brother.
Small world, yeah.
Yeah, Cornwall is weird for that, especially because there's weird connections all over the world because of the Great Emigration. Basically, in the history lesson incoming, in the late 19th century, there was this big... there wasn't a lot of work in Cornwall, and there was lots of mining going on in lots of other places. So the Cornish just went and set up communities in lots of other countries. So there's a big Cornish community in Mexico, there's a big Cornish contingent in Canada, Wisconsin, have pasty shops. Australia has a lot of Cornish people, and Jamaica has lots of Cornish people. And so it's like,
all that's so bizarre. I never would have thought about that, yeah. I think I noticed from what I saw you say is you do bring in quite a lot of you do bring in quite a lot of history and quite a lot of in an almost kind of idiot sort of way, like you do like kind of bringing in these sort of teaching resources almost into your comedy. Is that I just want to kind of explore a bit about that. How similar are your preparations to like lesson plans to like what you're going to talk about in comedy?
As a trainee teacher, I would say that my lesson plans are much more thorough and well thought out.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously, yeah.
Absolutely, definitely much more well thought out and not just written down on a piece of paper. And Certainly not. No trainee teacher would ever tell you that that's the way it works. Or even that, heaven forfend, that I write my lesson plans after the fact. No, that's ridiculous. How could anyone ever say that? That's the thing. I knew I started stand up first, which is kind of good in a way. Like stand up is sort of quite a good preparation for teaching in the sort of way that you can read a room.
Yeah.
So which was very handy when I was teaching in Warrington, and I was teaching at the college there, which is a vocational college. So I was teaching GCSE English resits.
Okay, yeah.
Which is really difficult because they're compulsory and nobody wants to be there. I can't blame them, you know?
Yeah.
They signed up for plumbing and construction, they didn't sign up to do more English.
That's really...
I failed three or four times. It's just okay, how do you keep this going? And try and remind them that there's more to it than just passing this exam. But when I was teaching there, it was really useful because if you're in a room full of builders, you can tell okay, if that goes on for two exchanges more, that's going to end up in a fist fight. it's quite handy when not to cast aspersions over the construction trade, because my whole family are plumbers and builders and that, but it does happen with the builders a lot. On a building site, you settle things very much by taking the piss out of each other, and it's a very blunt way of dealing and very straightforward, and you don't get that in more sort of academic circles. So being able to, and it's very a comedy club audience in that sense, especially when it's people that don't necessarily want to be there for the education and want to be there just because they need to have somewhere to sit and, have a bit of fun. So being able to bring that in is quite useful, but the problem is then you don't know how to deal with it.
I'm skilled enough to recognise that this is a problem, but not skilled enough to address
the
problem.
I'm not allowed to call these people cunts.
So
that's a serious safeguarding issue.
Yeah.
And I mean, the fact that I recognise that is progress.
Yeah, absolutely.
It shows that I'm on my way. But I don't know, I knew I was probably, I think I was probably destined to be a teacher. I don't believe in destiny in the slightest, but when people are sticking up their hands to heckle you in your stand-up shows, you're probably on your way.
Oh, that's amazing,
And most of the heckles I get aren't real heckles either, they're points of order or questions. I had one person ask me about dragons at a stand-up show.
Oh, fantastic. Was it in reference to something that you talked about earlier?
It was to do with Courtney Love. Not Courtney Love, very different.
Right,
But it was to do with the notion of Courtney Love and how it doesn't really exist as such. It's a thing that's been made up out of something that was made up out of something that was made up.
Okay,
so you talk about princes rescuing damsels from dragons and stuff like that, and it's all a little bit iffy, and then someone put up the hand and went, the dragons didn't really exist. And I was it depends how you translate the term Draco in the Latin, because Draco is a dragon in Latin, as you might know. But what you might not know is it also means serpent or lizard in Latin.
Okay, yeah.
So depending on how
that
you
makes sense, yeah.
depending on how you translate it, it means lots of different things.
I'm going to bring it...
Sorry.
No, that's all right. I had one question I wanted to ask before I changed the subject. You're talking about sort of skills you'd gained from comedy and applied to teaching. So just like a very quick question. Would you rather do a comedy gig to a bad audience or teach a bad class?
Oh, I would rather do a comedy gig to a bad audience.
Okay, do you, any particular...
I will tell you why, because I'm a history teacher. I justify my... I provide evidence.
Absolutely,
it's because if you're playing a comedy gig to a bad audience, they've paid to see you a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And also, you can do whatever you like within reason to that audience.
Yeah.
Because they're expecting it. There's a different contract
yes.
to a comedy gig
sure.
than there is a contract to the classroom.
Yeah.
There are no safeguarding regulations.
No. There's, could you imagine?
I mean, not in that kind of way, but like, you can't be... If you're teaching a bad class, what often is the case with a bad class is that they're a class that have been told they are stupid their entire lives.
Yeah.
I was a free school meals kid. I remember what it was like to come into school having had a really bad time and, you know, not really want to do holidays and all that kind of thing, even though I was having a really rubbish time at school as well. But that's all the thing that's always going to be in the back of your head when you're teaching is the... In a way that it's not when you're with a comedy audience, and that comedy audience becomes like a homogenous, weird group of blobs that are there for that night, and then they go and they never see you again. A bad class, you have to see again and again and again, and you get to know far too much about them to be able to deal with them in the same way that you would a comedy night. So in that sense, a bad comedy night. Is you can go at the end and think, I never have to see most of those people again. Whereas if you have a really bad class,
you can have to see them again tomorrow or next week or
you're like, I have a double with them tomorrow.
Oh no. That's a very good answer. I've got one more sort of big topic, and then I've got like a finishing question. I want to ask a bit about your writing and research process, because as I said before, from what I noticed, you do bring in like a lot of history and a lot of facts into your stand-up. So I was wondering if that's a thing that you specifically sort of research and write, or whether you just know everything anyway and bring in where it's relevant.
I definitely don't know everything. Let's make that very clear.
Well, no, but yeah.
Usually it's stuff like, I'm a fun collector of facts.
Yeah.
Like, I think my ideal job would be like host of QI. Like,
I can see you being really good at that, yeah.
I know, like, can someone just message John Lloyd and tell him? That'd be great. I like collecting facts. Like, one of my big comedy heroes is Mark Steele.
Yeah, I absolutely adore Mark Steele.
And that's why, because he manages to bring all these things to life in a way that a lot of people can't, really. And I find that, and I always try and make that clear in, like, when I'm teaching history and things like that, but, you know, it's about these little personal things. But it's about remembering, like, I remember things much more if they're funny.
Yeah.
So if there's a funny fact.
Yeah, you're more likely to remember, like, a joke than you are, like, a fact you need to know for class kind of thing.
Admittedly, I can never remember any jokes.
No.
No short jokes. Everyone's like, tell me a joke. I'm like, oh no. Especially considering like my PhD when I was doing it was in medieval humour. And everyone would be like, all right, tell me a medieval joke then. And I'm like, I can't remember any of them. And also, you don't want to hear them because they're all awful.
Yeah, I bet they are.
Yeah, I get lots of things like that. So like if there's something funny, I'm more likely to remember it. Like we're doing Henry VIII at the moment in my class.
Yeah.
And like half the stuff I'm just trying to remember by writing bad jokes about it. Like, and it's great because my class is getting into it as well because they've all got quite a good sense of humour.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
We had Cardinal Wolsey described as a fat gammon.
fantastic.
And I'm like, maybe don't put that in your exam, but yes. But yeah, like, you get things like that. So I think it's usually just facts that I picked up here and there, I've got a bit about Robert Stephen Hawker, who's a Cornish preacher. Mm. And there's a lot of things about him that are very mad. Like, he was an opium addict. So, you know, already you can imagine not great things are going to come of that, like, or slightly weird things are going to come of that.
Yeah.
But he's mostly famous for writing the song, the words to the song Trelawney, which is the Cornish national anthem. And I say that with entirely intended tone. it's basically the Grand Old Duke of York, but much less pro-English.
Okay, yeah, valid.
And it's, you know, he wrote that and it never actually happened. So he just kind of made it up a bit, like based on what they were gonna do.
Okay.
And then, but he's also famous for burying lots of, anyone who died at sea couldn't be buried on consecrated ground.
Okay, yeah.
Because often you didn't know who they were.
Right, yeah, of course, that makes sense, yeah.
He made the sailor's burial ground, like outside his hut where he went to write. So he basically had a little shed where he took opium and buried sailors, as you do.
Yeah, as you do indeed, yeah.
But he was a massive fire and brimstone preacher, and I learned about him from my grandpa. And it's the one thing, he told me one thing about him that always stuck, which was that he was such a fire and brimstone preacher because he was Methodist. Methodists can be like, people think of Methodists as being like really easygoing and all that kind of thing. Come to Cornwall. We've got cows and Methodists, that's what we do.
cows and Methodists.
But like, to the point, but it's like the sort of Methodist where you can get a drink at a funeral.
Right, okay, yeah.
Me and my family have taken sneaking in hip flasks funerals, like, just to make them a bit more interesting.
Just to liven up a bit, yeah.
But yeah, like, so it's all these very staunch Methodist types, and, but he was such a fire and brimstone preacher that everyone really didn't like it, and people stopped coming to his church. And so what he started doing was he made cardboard cutouts of his of his congregation and preached to them instead.
Oh, that's amazing. I need to start doing that at Blizzard when there's an audience, yeah.
I'm like, every comedy promoter needs to know this trick.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially now, yeah.
But yeah, like that's the thing, and he was so and he told me this, and he told me like so matter of factly, like it's just brilliant. Like my grandpa, again, it's that Cornish thing. Like my grandpa has a way of saying amazingly awful things and being quick content warning coming up for suicide.
Okay.
But I promise it is really funny. We were sat in a restaurant, me and my grandpa, and it was the first time we'd really had out just me and him.
Yeah.
That wasn't at, like, the field, or because we've got a field, and, you know, we've got chickens and like, occasionally cows.
Right.
I go up there and hang out with him, and he like, shows me things, and I'm like, Grandpa, where did you get the comic-style anvil? And he's like, well, it's an interesting story, my love. You see, it was 1958. And I were round Flavorass Harris's house, and I said one and do it. He said no, so I hadn't. And that's my grandpa. We were sat in this restaurant, and it was really nice. Like, I was like, oh my god, I'm having dinner with my grandpa. And he leaned over and just went, of course your Uncle Arthur committed suicide in this very room.
Fucking hell.
Okay. And there was only one other table of people in this restaurant at the time, and they got up and left.
Oh, no.
I was like, oh, my God.
Still, though, a whole restaurant to yourself, that must be something.
I know. And it, you know, and it turned out, like, yeah, it was my grandpa, it was my great-great-uncle's old butcher's shop. And, yeah, and that is what had happened there. And it's just like, why did you even say that? Why couldn't you wait until we left the restaurant? And I wasn't in the middle of eating. But, yeah, like, I kind of like that. I think that history is full of that kind of stuff. Like, it's full of things that, like, really, in a way, shouldn't be laughed about, but kind of have to be because they're so dark
yeah.
that if you can't find a reason to laugh about them, in a nice way. Like I never want to.
No, of course.
You never want to put anyone down.
No.
Or like you never punch down.
No, of course.
Like I've been teaching my history class this because we had real issues with it the other day.
Yeah.
And like trying to remind people that you don't punch down with your humour and going like, okay, they're 16, they don't quite understand this yet.
No.
You know, they're like the kids that used to turn up to like the open mic night I used to run and think they were really clever.
Yeah, I know the type.
Yeah. And it's like, and I mean, you know, a lot of us have been there. You know, I started out with some really horrible jokes that I would not do now. You know?
Oh yeah, same.
So I think it's part of that learning process and that growing up process. But I also think that there is some validity to Freud's theory of like release humour, that in some ways we kind of need to joke about, you know, things that are kind of dark and weird.
Yeah.
Especially because history is so full of them.
Yeah.
You know? Well, like, especially like now, can you imagine like some of the jokes people will be telling? I mean, some of the jokes we're even telling at the moment.
Yeah.
Like in terms of some of the very silly stuff about like what being in isolation is
like.
Yeah,
it's all the memes at the minute.
Exactly. And I think that's really lovely that actually what we've managed to do as a kind of generation is could come up with a language, and it's a comedy language.
Yeah, I do think it's important. Yeah.
And that's amazing. And I think like but how people might joke about this in the future.
Yeah.
Going to be really, really intriguing, and I find that I find all that stuff really interesting.
It's going to be interesting. It also touches a bit on a point that I have, like a lot of people with Blizzard have this preconception because we've got the content warning system and all that, and that it's kind of a soft audience. You need to be like sort of really tame and safe the entire thing. But everyone from there can like attest that's not the case at all. The audience do go for some incredibly incredibly dark stuff, and I think I don't want to discourage people from doing material about challenging topics and dark situations. That the issue is as you say with punching down. We want to get rid of that. And we want to make sure that people are prepared for the content that's going to come. But I would never dream of like trying to completely eliminate that from comedy, because I think it's important in tough times more than any other. Like it's why comedy thrives so much under Tory rule generally.
Yeah.
Like there's so much fantastic alternative comedy. Like it was literally born under Thatcher, and we've had a resurgence over the last decade. So
Even if you look at like the satire boom of the 60s, that was under Macmillan.
Yeah.
Like the first ever impersonation of a prime minister was Peter Cook doing Macmillan.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Tory Prime Minister.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's you know, it's really important. But
it's
really good that you have that system of being able to go, okay, this is what I'm going to, these are the things that I might touch upon. I'm sorry that I can't tell you all of them because comedy is just a fickle asshole.
Exactly. Yeah,
But these are some of the things, and it means that people are either prepared or have that choice, and I think that choice is everything.
Well, that's it, yeah, because I don't think anyone has ever really seen a content warning and then thought, I can't be in here for this. Certainly on live notes, but I think just having the fact that, like, okay, they thought about this, I can sort of brace myself for it. I don't know, if it does get too much, I can't leave. Which is the thing,
There's that real difference in PTSD of being, like, between, like, because I did a PTSD therapy course recently, and it was really, really interesting. A bit difficult because you sort of like they're all going, and how did you feel after? And they talk about like the incident in the forms you have to fill in a lot.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, okay, what if it's not an incident? What if it's sort of baked into your personality? And then we got through it quite well. But talking about it like that, it's like it's weird, like. If you're prepared for stuff like that, it's much easier to deal with than when you're blindsided. Like I lived 400 miles away from home, and I saw the back of someone's head that looked like the back of someone's head that was quite triggering, and I was completely shocked.
It can be the, I know that I'm not going to be able to like warn against all triggers, because there are some like that are very specific to a person that I can't possibly, but sort of like general themes and topics that I think, if someone's going to talk about mental health, that could be a difficult thing, or like some kind of like sexual assault or whatever, that could definitely bring up experiences.
Yeah, and that's so important. Having that space where people can go and feel like they're going to get the night out that they deserve, that they can, as far as they can handle it, it's a really important thing, and I think it's not a thing that enough places are doing in that sense.
Yeah, I can't think of anywhere. I mean, there may be other places, but I certainly can't think of anywhere that has a content warning system quite like that. Like, there are a few things that I borrowed from other nights, like the kind of audience interaction policy I borrowed from Quantum Leopard, or I think borrowed it from someone else originally anyway. But I don't, I don't know anywhere else that has that kind of content warning post.
I mean, having projector helps. But...
Initially, the way we did it is we did it sort of like in like a kind of music gig where there'd be sort of like A4 posters around the room that has like the set times of the different bands. So that's what I did originally, and then I was like, right, we've got a projector, I can just do it that way. And then
that's a great idea.
Yeah, because I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to sort of do like introduce acts and or like list content warnings for acts and introduce them, because I think that can be a bit little jarring for the act to sort of be like, oh, this person's going to talk about dead babies or something, and then they've got to go on kind of after that. Whereas sort of displayed on projector behind them, like you'll probably see it, but it doesn't interrupt the flow of the night in the same way. Which is I think a concern people sometimes have.
And I think if any trigger warning gives away your joke, then you are writing the wrong kind of joke.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
We had that problem when we were doing the content warnings for mine.
Yeah.
Which is me going, okay, there could be all of these things because I know all of these things about history that could come up, and they're all awful. Like, you know, like I could genuinely do my bit about the Black Death. I could end up doing my bit about however many people were massacred at the hands of, you know, like so and so. And it becomes awkward when like you're trying to talk about language when you're talking about history as well, because historical language gets so stuck in the past.
Yes.
So you hear a lot about the first transvestite prostitute.
Yeah.
And actually, how I would describe that is probably the first transgender sex worker. Because from what I can tell from the trial notes, which are very weird, it's an unusual trial because they don't usually go into things that aren't their jurisdiction. And they did. But I think it's because it was so odd to them that they kind of felt it had to be written down. But, you know, Eleanor Rickner, who is continually referred to as John Rickner, and I'm not sure should be, but, like, you talk about that in terms of, like... I mean, not that I'd ever talk about it at a comedy night, but it's an interesting thing, thinking about how you talk about things, history in comedy.
Mm.
But because historical language, because it's all written by old men
a
lot of the time, it's usually about 30 years behind where language is. Which is very upsetting because I'm pretty sure the guy who's mostly written about Eleanor Rickner is my old PhD supervisor, and he'd be so hurt if he thought that he was using language that hurt anyone. But he's just, you know, he's a 50-something-year-old white guy who doesn't who basically lives in a world of academia. He doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. And I think that's the same sort of thing. I think I kind of get that because it's the same sort of thing I get from Cornwall, which is like, because Cornwall's about 20 years behind everyone.
Yeah,
as well.
Like,
it's what's become so weird having lived in the city and doing, I say the city, I've lived up the country.
Well,
But, you know, like having the sort of circles that I do where I, you know, I know a lot of trans people and I know a lot of people of different cultures. And, you know, and I'm definitely consider myself, you know, one of you guys.
Yeah.
You lot. And you know, to the extent where I'm that careful about my language. But after however long of being in Cornwall, it slipped back into that. It becomes really interesting when you're trying to sort of navigate those boundaries. But I think it's why I wanted to move back here.
Yeah.
Is because it's where I'm kind of needed in that sense.
Yeah.
Like, needs to be, we need to understand as a duchy, as a county, as a country, whatever you consider Cornwall to be.
Yeah.
Need to consider that it's not okay. Just because we treat the people all right, it's not okay to use that kind of language about them. Because, you know, you speak to my grandparents and things like that, and they will protect any person who they considered was a good person, and it doesn't really matter. But they don't quite... They get the weirder bits of it. Like, my grandpa recently got introduced to the notion of being transgender, and he's, like, surprisingly good about it.
I feel like a lot of people are, like, you often...
Like, my... But you have to kind of, like, explain it in the right way.
Yeah.
In a weird way. And, like, my gran is completely fine with the notion of, because I'm bi and I came out to my grandparents because I love my grandparents and I can't imagine keeping stuff like that from them because it feels kind of weird. Mm. And my grandmother, I was like, well, I'll be honest, you know, I like women too. And my grandmother went, well, I'm surprised you even like men in the first place. They're awful.
Fucking fantastic.
And that's kind of like the way my gran thinks, but like, it's like navigating that weird space between those places. I find really interesting, and I think it's going to be such a really fascinating bit of culture to try and navigate because things change so much more quickly than when they used to. Mm, like when you look at like the Middle Ages, because. But again, this is the problem of having to mention things like halfway through, being from the Middle Ages. No, I'm not from the Middle Ages. I am a medievalist. Not the same thing. I promise it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's not. but like being a medievalist is like things change really quite slowly.
Yeah.
In the Middle Ages. Like.
I suppose they didn't have the same kind of like communications network and stuff, so you don't...
It changes more than people think, and the Middle Ages is a lot more accepting than people think.
Yeah.
Like, there were definitely a lot more black people than people think there were.
Of course there were, the history's been kind of whitewashed,
Yeah, it really has. Yeah. And that's all the Victorians. Like, the Victorians are just the worst. Like, the more I learn about history, the more I learn Victorians are the worst people.
I'm going to use that sound clip of you just saying that the Victorians are the worst as kind of like the trailer for this.
Oh, please do,
It could be the title, just Mabel Slattery, Victorians are the worst.
It would be my thesis statement to anything.
Absolutely,
I did consider like starting like a full-on podcast in which I explain why Victorians are the worst bit by bit.
I mean, if you want to do it, then now's the time. You've got plenty of
time. But everyone's starting a podcast. Come on, I can't.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a jumper as well, so.
Yeah, so I'm just going to finish up with one last question. Take your time if you want. So it's what bit of advice has stayed with you the most in your comedy career?
Mum, what was your advice when I started doing comedy?
What was my advice when you started doing comedy?
Yeah.
Not to take it seriously.
My mum says it wasn't to take it serious, not to take it seriously.
There we are. Short and sweet.
Yeah. Don't take it too seriously. I think that's definitely a good maxim for everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was Mabel Slattery. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to support Blizzard Comedy, you can do so by visiting our website, blizzardcomedy.co.uk/support-us. There may be an underscore in there. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it'll be in the description below anyway, so you can just follow it there. You can also support us on Patreon, and you can follow us on a variety of different platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, where our partner series for this little podcast series, Blizzard Comedy Archives, is found And if you are one of our Patreon supporters, you can vote after every episode on whose full chat you would like to hear. And then, so yeah, if there's anyone in particular who you really like on that series and you really want to hear more about, you can vote for them, and then maybe they will be the subject of the next episode of this series. So yep, if you are someone who is able to financially support us, that would be absolutely wonderful. If you are not, then and you still want to support us, there's plenty of ways you can. Just shout about us on social media, keep the interest going, and share all about us and these fabulous comedians that we showcase. Because in some cases, these people have lost their only source of income and need need now more than ever people to be supporting their digital content and just kind of keeping them going, essentially. And not only from a financial point of view, but also this is what they do with their lives, and having to suddenly stop with no clear end in sight is not the most fun thing in the world. So yeah, if you are able to help out, support your local comedy industry and your favorite acts online, the one advantage of this being, of course, is that the kind of overall reach that these comedians have with their content is now, there's a lot more potential to do that, because the internet has far more capacity than a small room in a pub, so far more people can watch the content. I'm a fucking philosopher, me. Anyway, yeah, thank you so much for watching, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye bye.